They're reunited. They get away from the Duke and the Duchess finally. They're riding again. They come upon, I'm going to do this very quickly. This is one of the last, it's not quite an adventure. It's just magnificent. They come upon these big sculptures covered in cloth. Quixote's mystified, and they go look under the cloth, and they are carvings of great saints. And they're being carried to a shrine where they will eventually be put up. And Quixote is looking at them and begins explaining to Sancho who each of the great saints is. It's a beautiful moment. And again, what you realize, well, he's only mad in some ways, and he's beautiful descriptions. He sees St. George. He sees St. Martin. My favorite, he uncovers one of the sculptures, and it's St. Paul. Don Quixote said, "This was the greatest enemy our Lord God's church had in his time, and the best defender it will ever have, a knight errant by his life and a peaceful saint in his death, a tireless laborer in the vineyard of the Lord and teacher of the Gentiles. He had heaven for his school and Jesus Christ himself for his professor and master." Just beautiful. Just beautiful. The image of this old madman uncovering the sculptures and teaching Sancho who each of these saints is. We're coming to the end of the book. We're coming to the end of the book. Mentioned it before, the bachelor Samson Carrasco has been out riding around trying to find Quixote and stop him. The beginning of part one, he comes disguised as the Knight of the Woods and the Knight of the Mirrors, challenges Quixote thinking it'll be a cinch. Quixote beats him, wins. And the bachelor doesn't understand what's happened. So he goes back, regroups, and comes back at the end of part two as the Knight of the White Moon. Armor, visor, challenges our knight. Why the white moon? Because the moon has always been the symbol of change. Change. Constantly changing. And Quixote's fortunes are about to change. He's been riding now for 700 pages. Okay, and he's growing older and older. And the vision is faltering at moments. I did go through many of the passages. They're there. They're beautiful. They're heartbreaking. They're funny. But as a result, he's conquered. He is conquered by the Knight of the White Moon. And he's abashed. He's horrified. Because it means, basically, he's failed his lady. All the ideals he's tried to uphold, he has failed to defend. And the Knight of the White Moon gives him the following order, okay? Because Quixote says, "Drive your lance home, knight, and rid me of life since you have robbed me of honor. I'd rather die now." And the Knight of the White Moon says, "That I will not do, I swear. Let the renown of the Lady Dulcinea del Toboso's beauty live unimpaired. For all the satisfaction I ask is that the great Don Quixote de la Mancha," he compliments him, "that the great Don Quixote de la Mancha shall retire to his village for a year, or until such time as I please, as was agreed between us before entering upon the battle. Go home for a year. All you have to do is leave the field of battle, give up adventures for a year." Now, Quixote is an honorable knight. And this happens in Barcelona, by the way. They've made their way to Barcelona. So he will do, since he was not victorious but defeated, he will do what's required of him. This is just, oh my. This is the opening of chapter 66. As they left Barcelona, Don Quixote turned to gaze on the spot where he had fallen and said, "Here stood Troy. Here my ill luck, and not my cowardice, despoiled me of the glory I had won. Here fortune practiced her shifts and changes upon me. Here my exploits were eclipsed. Here, in short, my happiness fell, never to rise again." Hearing which, Sancho said, great hearts, my dear master, should be patient in misfortune as well as joyful in prosperity. And this I judge from myself, for I was merry when I was governor. Now that I'm a squire on foot, I'm not sad. For I've heard tell that Fortune, as they call her, is a drunken and capricious woman, and worse still, blind. And so she doesn't see what she's doing, and doesn't know whom she is casting down or raising up. You are very philosophical, Sancho, replied Don Quixote, and you talk most wisely. I don't know how you have learned to. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. And they head home. On the way home, he undergoes a further indignity. I'm not going to read it, but I'll just talk about it. He's riding home when suddenly, it's like that moment in part one where the dust cloud appears. And the dust cloud appears and these funny noises, and a whole bunch of hogs are being driven to market. And they trample him in the dust. There are so many of them. They run over Rocinante, knock him to the ground, and Quixote has this herd of pigs running over him. And it's like the ultimate indignity. Ultimate indignity. He picks himself up and goes home. Those of us who are Catholic should know why Cervantes puts that at this point and at the end of the book. The herd of swine, the Gadarene swine, out of whom Christ drove the demons, out of the madman, and sent them into the pigs who went racing off the cliff. And what happens at that moment is Quixote begins to recover his senses. It's a blessing from God. And Cervantes uses the parallel from the Gospels, that suddenly the madman, if you remember, it's glorious. We are told, and the madman recovered his senses and went and sat at the feet of Christ, and the people were amazed. It's the healing of the madman. He gets home, he takes to his bed. He becomes such a changed man, they begin to worry for him. Sancho is heartbroken. His master seems to be gone. He pleads with him to rise up and go on another adventure. Quixote can't. Then Sancho says, well, let's go into the forest and play shepherds. Let's go live a pastoral, simple life. Because they talk about it at one point in the book, and Quixote won't do it. He becomes more and more ill. And, very odd to have a great comedy end with death. Okay? Very, very odd. He sleeps, he has to be left alone. He wants to sleep a little. He sleeps for a long time. He woke and cried out loudly, "Blessed be God Almighty, who has vouchsafed me this great blessing. Indeed, his mercies are boundless, nor can the sins of men limit or hinder them." His niece was listening. She asked him, "What is it you say, sir? Is there anything new? What mercies are these? What sins of men?" "The mercies, niece, are those which God has shown me at this moment. Mercies to which, as I have said, my sins are no impediment. My judgment is now clear and free from the misty shadows of ignorance, which my ill-starred and continuous reading of those detestable books of chivalry had obscured it. Now I know their absurdities and their deceits, and the only thing that grieves me is that the discovery has come too late, and leaves me no time to make amends by reading other books which might enlighten my soul. Call my good friends, my dear, the priest, Bachelor Samson Carrasco, Master Nicholas the Barber, for I want to confess and make my will." But his niece was excused this task by the entrance of the three, and the moment Quixote saw them, he exclaimed, "Congratulate me, good sirs, for I am Don Quixote de la Mancha no longer, but Alonso Quijano called for my way of life the good. He knows who he is. And for the first time in the book, we get his real name, Alonso Quijano the Good. Now I am the enemy of Amadis of Gaul and of all the infinite prude of his progeny. Now all profane histories of knight-errantry are odious to me. I know my folly and the peril I've incurred from reading of them. Now, by God's mercy, I have learned from my own bitter experience, and I abominate them. Up to now, they have been only too real to my cost, but with heaven's aid, my death shall turn them to my profit. I feel, sirs, that I am rapidly dying. Stop your fooling, and bring me a priest to confess me, and a clerk to make my will. For in such extremities as this, a man must not jest with his soul. So send for a clerk, I beg of you, while my friend the priest confesses me. The priest hears his confession, he makes his will, and dies with Sancho and his friends weeping at his bedside. It's called a good death. It's called a good death. Cervantes, shortly after writing those words, died after having confessed to a priest, having made his will with his friends at his bedside. It's a profound Catholic book. We are all fallen. We are all touched with ignorance and error. We are all fools in our times and madmen, trying our best, trying to uphold ideals we believe in, and failing because we're not seeing clearly, don't understand reality, making bad choices. But at the end, God's mercy is infinite. And if we stay close to him and remember the most important things in our faith, may he grant us such a good death. Don Quixote de la Mancha rides out of the book onto immortal literary fame. Alonso Quijano the Good dies in God's grace. May God grant us all such a good death. Thank you. I have time for questions, certainly. Happy to take questions. So the first one's the hardest. Somebody be bold, and then we can... Yes.
Do you think Cervantes was playing on perhaps Don Quixote being like a Protestant and Sancho a Catholic?
That's hard to say because Quixote throughout the book is stating Catholic truths. He knows his faith backwards and forwards. Again, the problem is not what he believes. It's this misguided... let me put it this way. It's his disconnection from reality. The books have put him up in the clouds. He's not living in reality. But everything in him is basically good and decent. He's not seeing clearly. He's up in the clouds. He's confused. But everything in him... I would say the initial impulse where Cervantes begins the book is a sense of the dangers of the Protestant attitude. But Cervantes clearly was so Catholic at his core. He couldn't write a Protestant book or a Protestant character. So Quixote speaks the faith, understands it at his best moments, but there are moments he's just completely nuts. And you know what can you say? There's a sense in this book. One reason that Quixote is so popular and has been, he's all of us. I mean, we really all. It's his fallen nature. It's the confusion. It's the mistakes. And yet, at the same time, he's trying to hold on to something. Dostoevsky says at one point that, in a way, on the judgment day, this mankind, when we're judged as a whole, should present this book to God himself, because this is us. Trying to do what we could, but just failing miserably. And here's the record of what was good in us and what was so miserable in us, and hope again for his mercy that... that he'll forgive us. But of course, the ability is there. It's the sacraments. I find that ending just overwhelmingly moving. And you all, those of you that know Bride's Head, it's the end of Bride's Head, where a good death at the end of the book changes everything. I mean, it's if there's a Catholic story, and it's the fascinating, for me, one of the fascinating aspects of the Catholic faith is that this life is a pilgrimage. Now, the great saints are there all along. Many of us are bumbling and fallen, and thank God for confession and the sacraments and being able to go to Mass and try to improve and working at it. But when it comes to the end, that's the moment of definition. That's the moment of decision. And how we end up makes an eternal difference. And being Catholics, even those who may be fallen away or crazy, if the faith is in them, they know what to do. It's called get a priest. Make a confession. Get last rites. Be prepared to stand before God. This is judgment. And if you're Catholic, I'll tell you, one of the most frightening things happening in the Novus Ordo Church is this notion that everybody goes to heaven. I find that just terrifying. I know the story. I knew the woman. Her elderly father was a devout man, went to Mass every Sunday, went to confession regularly, grew old. He was very old. The church changed. It came time for his death. And he said to his daughter, call a priest for me. My time has come. She called the parish priest, who said, oh, I'm really busy right now. Tell him I can't make it, but tell him he's fine. And the old man went into death in horror, terrified, because for him it still mattered. He knew the importance of that moment, and the priest wasn't there for him, because the priest just assumed, oh, he's fine, everybody goes to heaven. Very dangerous. Now, we don't know how God will judge that man. All we know is at the end, I don't know if you remember the moment in Bride's Head where it's Lord Marchmain's mistress. Lord Marchmain is dying, and the family's debating, what do we do? He threw the priest out before. Do we send him in? Do we send the priest back in? What do we do? And the mistress says, well, I don't know. I can't decide. And then she says, all I know for certain is when my end comes, I want a priest. That means there's something Catholic in the core. So she may be a sinner, but there's still something Catholic in the core. And but you've got to have that Catholic core in you from the time you're young. You have to be taught the truths of the faith when you're young and get them in there. So even if you fall away or go crazy or have troubles in the world or whatever, when the time comes, you have in you that basic impulse where you know what to do, which is, before I stand before God, however I've lived my life, I hope for the good, but maybe not for the good, maybe a sinful life, I must see a priest. I must see a priest. That's why, gentlemen, for all the hard work you're doing, and all the frustrations I'm sure that occur at times, and the desperate situation that's out there in the church and in the world, you are doing the most important work that young men can do. And that's why I salute you. Because your vocation is about the salvation of immortal souls for all eternity. What an extraordinary thing to do. What a great gift our Lord gave us in the priesthood. So persevere. Persevere. Keep going. Yes.
When you taught the book at the Naval Academy, how did this book affect your students? Did it help them?
Some of them. It's the way it works. Some fall asleep. Some are more concerned with their electrical engineering exam that's coming up. And then you can see the ones who the eyes click open. Part of that, to be honest, is the mystery of living in the world and the mystery of grace. Who knows? But I will tell you this, you don't know which ones are going to be touched by it. The great mystery of teaching is there may be the one who is sleeping or worried about the electrical engineering exam who I hear from 8 years later who will say, I remember when you talked about the ending of Don Quixote and you said this, could we talk about that some more? And I'm in an email exchange and thought, I can't believe it. I thought that person was a dunce. Didn't hear a word I said all semester. You do not know. The teacher scatters seed. Again, it's the parable of our Lord. It's a parable of our Lord. You don't know which seed's going to grow, which one's going to fall on the rock. You don't know. So being a teacher, you have to be the sower of seed and trust God to decide where it will grow and where it won't. You just scatter it. And you're always surprised at some of the seed that takes root and grows into a magnificent plant. You never would have predicted it. But then it's not for, my vision is faulty. I can't predict that. I don't know. So it varies hugely. Yes?
Would you say that Sansón Carrasco goes mad in his efforts to try to stop Don Quixote?
Well, this is what's interesting. Quixote is so persuasive, everybody around him ends up acting like him. Even the same people. The priest and the barber and the bachelor all at times take on, his niece, the moment when they burn the books and they brick up his library. Quixote wakes up and goes to his library and there's no door there. The room is gone. And his hand is running over the bricks where the doorway used to be, and he's mystified. And that's when his niece says, oh, yes, the room was here, but the enchanter Freston came. She says the enchanter so-and-so came and carried it off. He said, no, you must mean Freston. It was Freston who did it. He knows which one of the enchanters would have done that. But they all play along with him. But I'll tell you, I am told this is true. It is very possible with those who are really nuts, their vision is so convincing they can draw sane people into it. It can happen. Got a story. Oh, this is a joke. A man's driving along. It's middle of the day, and he blows a tire on his car, and he's right next to an insane asylum, and the inmates are having their walk around the yard. So he gets out, and he's undoing the tire, and he takes the four lug nuts off and puts them in the rim of the hubcap. And there's one guy who's standing at the fence watching him, just glaring at him. He's very, please. Now I have a flat tire, and I've got this lunatic who's watching me change my tire. And he's so self-conscious, he doesn't see what he's doing. He steps back, steps on the hubcap, and all four lug nuts go bloop, bloop, bloop down the sewer. So now he's standing with a flat tire, no lug nuts, and this madman is just glaring. So he stands there for a while, and he has no idea what to do. And finally the madman says, excuse me, sir. I might suggest that what you should do is remove one lug nut from each of the other three tires and put three lug nuts on the new tire on your car. That way you will have three lug nuts on each tire and would be able to drive safely. The man looks at him and says, I don't mean to be rude, but I thought you were crazy. And the man says, I may be crazy, sir, but I'm not stupid. It's a wonderful joke. Wonderful joke. Oh, well. What could you say? Yes.
Is there any advice you can give us so as to read literature well?
Slowly, regularly, and aloud. One thing you've got to realize, when books came in, they were a mode of entertainment. You didn't just buy a book and read it. It was possible to be solitary, but as time went on, that became family entertainment. The father would buy a book and read to his family, so that a lot of people heard books before they ever read them. And I still believe that the best literature can be received through the ear. There's a wonderful story of the great American writer Henry James, who loved Dickens, and his father got the first installment of David Copperfield when it came out, but James was young and he was sent to bed. And his father was reading Copperfield to the rest of the family, and James, at peril of his life, crawled out of his bed and crawled to the top of the steps and sat there trying not to breathe so he wouldn't be discovered as he listened to his father read David Copperfield. So reading aloud, hugely important. Slowly, enjoy it. I mean, again, there has to be a sense of, it's for leisure time, and we don't have a lot of it. We have very little, which, by the way, let me say one other thing. I have no problem at all with books on tape or CD. Those who read them are almost always good readers. You might even have the books abridged some, but even so, I mean, you're going to do a lot of traveling around, and it might be a good thing to do. Those audiobooks are good. You can listen to them, and you'll get the book, and you'll hear them well read, and that's the way many of them were first introduced. People read them aloud. I see nothing wrong with that. I encourage people to do it. Especially in this world where there's no time. No time. Take advantage of what time you have and listen to a good book. It can be very helpful. And if it's a good reader, the good reader will help you understand the book. Again, John Berryman, God rest his soul, the poor man, told about a class. He said it was the best course he ever took as an undergraduate at Columbia University. Old professor teaching a course called the Russian novel. He walked in the first class and said, "This semester we will do Tolstoy's Anna Karenina." Plopped the book down, opened it, started reading page one. Students were like, "What is this?" The man came every class and read aloud to them from Anna Karenina. By the end, had finished the book, and Berryman said it was the best class I ever took. Why? Because his reading taught us the book. When we heard him read it, he knew it so well, he didn't have to comment. By reading the book to us, he taught us the book. I understand. I didn't when he told me the story 40 years ago. Now I understand it. Because it's a way of conveying knowledge. Yes?
Why are only some of Sancho Panza's proverbs relevant to what he's talking about?
Sancho's proverbs are wonderful. Yes, some are relative, many are not. It's one reason he drives Quixote crazy. Quixote keeps erupting as Sancho, because once he starts, he can't stop. It's like a computer program, and some of them you have to run from the beginning to get to wherever you want to be. For Sancho, these proverbs are all packed in there. And if he has a proverb he wants to quote, he's got to run through all of them that he knows. And he just drives Quixote crazy. Just crazy. And occasionally they're relevant. And 90% of the time, it's a motor mouth. Proverb after proverb after proverb that has nothing. The other wonderful moment is, it's early in the book where he says he has a story to tell Quixote. And he starts telling the story about this guy who's taking goats across the stream, and says to Quixote, "But now you've got to keep track of how many goats he's taken across." So he took a goat across the stream, then he came back. Then he took another goat across the stream, dropped it off, then he came back. Got another goat, and he took it. This goes on and on and on. And Quixote says, "Sancho, be done with the goats. Get on with the story." And Sancho says, "Well, how many did he get across?" And Quixote says, "I don't know how many got across." Sancho says, "Well, then I can't finish the story." It's just, part of that is a little joke about, and it's appropriate in this book, trusting the storyteller, okay? That there's somehow a bond between the one telling the story and the one hearing the story. Well, Cervantes is playing off that through the whole book, but it may be the only time Sancho tries to tell a story, he can't do it because he's so bogged down in the details. He can't go on until all the goats get across. And he doesn't remember, and Quixote didn't count them. So, well, then I can't continue the story. That's wonderfully funny. Yes.
Dr. White, Why does Cervantes end the book with Cid Hamete?
He ends the book with... It's the last joke. It's the last joke. Yes, he ends with Cid Hamete Benengeli. although there's a nice touch at the end. The most prudent Cid Hamete to his pen. Here you shall rest, hanging from this rack by this copper wire, my goose quill. We get the farewell from the Arabic historian. It's Cervantes speaking himself. But the man has trouble being serious. Imagine, if you will, what it means to finish a book like this. Over 10 years in the writing, he's old, he doesn't have much time left. He knows it's the only thing he'll be remembered for. It's the one great thing he's done in his life. He comes to the close of it. I would say perhaps he's distancing himself. It is a comic novel. He's afraid of... I mean, the emotions had to be overwhelming. And this is a man of deep emotion. He distances it by giving the last words to the most prudent Cid Hamete Benengeli. Okay? But you hear some of these words in its Cervantes. For me alone Don Quixote was born, and I for him. His was the power of action, mine of writing. Only we two are at one. I mean, that's Cervantes. That's Cervantes. It's a last joke. It's a last joke. Indeed, he died. He died about a year after the book was finished. He finished one other book. It's a romance called The Adventures of Perseus and Sigismunda. I've read it. It's a very good book. It's very nice, but what it doesn't have are those two characters. Those two characters who are just unforgettable. But please notice, for me alone was Don Quixote born, and I for him. Cervantes knew he was born to write this book. Again, God gives us a purpose in life. The greatest thing that can happen to you in this life, and I count myself a fortunate man, is to find out what God intended you to do and be able to do it. Because he has a plan for all of us. I look at the young who are puzzled, don't know where to go, what to do, aren't sure of themselves. Be patient and pray for guidance. I will tell you, I don't know if I've told this story. Who remembers? I remember nothing now. I had left the job at Temple. I didn't want to live in Philadelphia. I didn't like I liked the city, but I couldn't live in a big city. I just couldn't do it. It wasn't in my nature. I was looking for another job, and I couldn't find one. I couldn't find a job. And I remember I was close to despair and thought, well, my teaching career is over. I guess it lasted 10 years. Where do I go? What do I do? And it got worse and worse, and I had applied everywhere, nothing. I swear to you, I remember mid-afternoon, I went and knelt by my bed, close to despair, and prayed to God to direct me to what I was supposed to do because I was at my wit's end. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. I said, I just submit myself. Use me as your instrument. Send me where I'm supposed to go. Let me do whatever you want me to do, but let me know what it is. I got up from my knees, walked to the mailbox, and had an interview with the Naval Academy. Just like that. And for 28 years, I was where I was supposed to be, doing what I was supposed to do, often as miserably as poor Quixote. But at least I know that's where I was supposed to be. That's what I was to do. And so trust in him. Trust in him. If you ask, he will show you. He will direct you. And I'll tell you, I said to myself, the Naval Academy. And then I remembered the last thing I had done the previous summer. I directed a production in Summerstock Theater of Mr. Roberts, the great American Navy play. I just spent a year studying the Navy. And I went, okay, I'll go to the Naval Academy. That Naval Academy! But that's where it was supposed to be, yes.
Doctor, would you have time to discuss what you refer to as the smoking gun? to show that Shakespeare was Catholic?
Yeah, oh, certainly. Certainly I can do this. For centuries, it was assumed Shakespeare had no faith. He grew up at a time of huge religious torment, this brilliant man who everybody admits was raised Catholic, but he didn't care about it. And there's the level of scholarship that went on, okay? Just, duh. Well, we don't believe in it, so he couldn't. We don't believe in it. I'm brilliant. He was brilliant. Therefore, he couldn't have believed in it. That's the supposed logic. There had been stirrings recently. There was a great professor at the end of the 19th century who said, we've got to look into this. The religious question did not just dominated everything in England at that point, and Shakespeare wasn't interested. There is a whole fruitful path of scholarship here that we must pursue, and they just, he was ignored. Then recently people started looking into it, except very few Shakespeare professors, although it's begun now, okay? But what I call the smoking gun is this. There is one Shakespeare work. It's a poem called The Phoenix and the Turtle. Written in 1601, a single poem published in a collection of poems on the subject of the phoenix and the turtle. And Shakespeare was one of them. It's clearly by him. It's a very mysterious poem. For 400 years, people have tried to figure out what he's writing about. It's clearly a married couple he writes about. And the turtle has died, and the phoenix just dies, and their love was chaste, but was an immortal love, and all the birds are being called to the memorial service for the phoenix. And it ends with a threnos, a funeral hymn sung for the phoenix. Nobody had any idea what it was about. They tried, nothing made sense. A philosophy professor from Oxford and a law professor from Louisiana State University cracked the poem. Both Catholics who had an avocation of studying English religious history questions at Shakespeare's time and put together and published in the Times Literary Supplement a long article where they explain every line in the poem. Every line. The poem was clearly written in honor of English martyr Anne Lyne, who was arrested on Candlemas Day, February 2nd, 1601, and hanged at Tyburn at the end of the month, February 27th, 1601. She had a priest in her home blessing candles, and there would have been a hidden mass there when the authorities came. The priest escaped, she was arrested, and hanged at Tyburn the end of the month. What we do know, her body was thrown in a ditch. She had been married to a convert. She was a convert. Her husband was a convert. He was arrested and banished from England and died in Belgium. So they were married briefly, and it was a chaste marriage. Both of them ended up, devout and died for the faith. There was a private memorial held by Catholics in her honor. She was given a proper burial, and the head of the Jesuits in England at that time went to Rome to let all the material be recorded as to the sacrifice she had made. Okay? The poem is written pretty obviously in honor of English martyr Anne Lyne, and they go through and explain every reference. I'll just give you a couple of quick ones. There is, I don't have time to get into this in detail. The poem is usually called the only metaphysical poem Shakespeare ever wrote. It's loaded with obscure images and philosophical discussion. And there are lines in there that are very hard to understand, that nobody's ever figured out what it is. They discovered the source of these passages. They're from Euclid's Geometry. And he uses them because in Euclid they are the definition of, guess what? A line. A line. So Shakespeare takes from Euclid the definition of a line and uses it as part of the poetry in honor of Anne Lyne and her husband Roger Lyne, who both died for the faith. Then when the threnos comes and the phoenix is dead, and the other birds are gathering to sing the funeral hymn in her memory, The poem goes from a four-line structure to a three-line structure. An line dies, and what happens to the poem? It loses a line. You read this and you realize these guys are brilliant. And they hit every obscure reference and explain it. Letters came in to the TLS is edited by the Duke and the Duchess. Okay? The TLS is edited by the Duke and the Duchess. A couple of letters came in with additional support. Say, did you notice this? Not one letter of contradiction or disproving anything they said. And from the day it was printed, it has been non-existent in Shakespeare studies. It's as if they never printed it. Except for a madwoman, the Duchess, who edited a new volume of Shakespeare's poetry, who says at the beginning, no, I think it was written for an earl in Scotland, and I read their thing, and I don't believe it. Oh, well, on that basis, then. Oh, well, then it's obviously not true. No, it's just superb. It's, unfortunately, the TLS makes you subscribe to go into their archives to find the article. Creeps. But it's out there. But as I call it, the smoking gun, what it does is connect Shakespeare with the Catholic underground. Those who went and found the body and preserved it and honored it. There were other many, many hidden Catholics in Elizabeth's time. There were some prominent ones. In fact, the first line is a reference to one of the most prominent Catholics who was Queen Elizabeth I's court composer, William Byrd, who was not only a Catholic, but an in-your-face Catholic, even to the Queen. But she liked his music so much, it was sort of like, you know, well, he's crazy, but we'll let him go back, because I really like the music. The first line of the poem, let the bird of loudest lay from the sole Arabian tree, sad herald and trumpet be, to his call all birds obey. Well, the bird of loudest lay, okay, it's a pun. There's one bird who can prominently call all the other birds together and get away with it. It's William Byrd. But what we have in the poem is the bird calling all the other birds to this ceremony of the birds from the sole Arabian tree. Well, what's that? It's the palm. What's the palm the symbol of? Martyrdom. In the first two lines, you have a reference to martyrdom. And William Byrd, who's the only one who could prominently talk about his faith and get away with it. We know for a fact Byrd composed a motet in honor of Anne Lyne to be sung at the service. I'm guessing Shakespeare wrote the poem for the same reason and then published it. It was published just in April of 1601, almost immediately afterwards. But he just goes all the way through. And they go through all the way through, explain every reference. It's magnificent. Smoking gun has been found. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Yes.
Dr. White, you mentioned the fact that at one point Cervantes has Don Quixote look at some statues of some saints, and at that point he compares the saints or calls them the knights errants of Christianity. What would one say to the argument that here Cervantes is perhaps pointing out the dangers of an excess Christianity, insofar as he compares them to knights errant and knight errantry, which Quixote at the end of the book turns out rejecting and saying that this is all bad and I've made a mistake. So what might we say to that argument?
It's one of those moments, what can you say? He is still mad when he says it, okay? He's losing his faith in knight errantry, but he's still hanging on to it. But what he's doing at that point is recognizing, and it's what I said earlier, knight errantry, the whole concept, grew out of France, which is indeed a Catholic nation, always has been, producing extraordinary Catholic saints as well as some other things that we won't mention in the presence of prominent French people. It's very funny. I'm not sharing any secrets, but someone, when we were gathered just recently, I was with the other priest, said France brings out the best and the worst. It seems to do that. One of the things I'm proudest of in my life is I got to write a book about maybe the great, to my mind, the great man of our age, and he was a Frenchman. Okay, so they continue to produce great, the French continue to produce great saintly defenders of the faith. Knight-errantry grew out of that. There is a Catholic connection. So in a curious way, the criticism is that Quixote takes it too far and becomes nuts with it. There is a sense in which the ideals of knight-errantry are defendable and grow out of the solidity of certain aspects of Catholic faith. As with anything, you can take it too far. It's the Jansenists in France who took the faith and went too far. You can take anything and go too far with it. It's the notion, it's Aristotle's notion of the golden mean. You've got to find that middle place. You've got to find the balance. You go too far on either direction, and you're going to be in trouble. So Quixote's gone too far, and he's not fully recovered yet. Insofar as many of the great saints were out in the world and fighting for the faith, at least in terms of putting it forward in a hostile world, there's much truth in what he says. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
Does that phony second part of Don Quixote, does that still exist?
It exists. When I did the seminar, I had a student who, for his seminar paper, found a copy of it and wrote his seminar paper on the phony second part, brought me a copy. I couldn't read more. I dipped into it. It's just terrible. It's just, you can imagine Cervantes getting a copy of this and reading it. But brilliantly, instead of just getting angry, he incorporates it into part two. Well, he immortalized the man. The only reason he's remembered now is because Cervantes puts him in part two. It's just a terrible book. Just terrible. But it allowed him another chance for a narrative joke. Yes.
Do you go back to statues where Quixote is teaching Sancho?
You're right.
We never hear Sancho really talk about like Catholic ideals. Is there an idea like, is there any speculation as to whether he's Catholic or not?
Oh, absolutely. He is. He talks about it constantly. In fact, let me give you one. Oh, I hope I can find this. I hope I wrote it down. Oh, golly, I may not have. Oh, phooey. Give me 1 minute here. Oh, shucks. I wasn't going to read this publicly. I wasn't going to do this in public. And now I've got to, please let me find this. See, I'm not going to be able to now. It's a shame. Let me put it this way. Sancho makes a declaration of his faith at one point, okay? That's absolutely magnificent. He says he's not necessarily good in all the time in what he believes, okay? He's well aware that he's a sinner, but he makes a very touching, simple man's declaration of faith. Oh, golly, I'm not going to be able to find it. I'm so disappointed. And then he ends it by openly talking about his animosity towards a certain other group who shall remain nameless at this point. This very simple man's declaration of his faith and what he believes in as a good Catholic and trying to believe in what Holy Mother Church teaches, and I hate the... Yes, time is up, folks. I need to hit the road and see my dear aunt. God willing, if the crick don't rise and I'm invited, I'll be back. Thank you all very much. Thank you.